We're going to be talking about Samson today. Every schoolboy knows of Samson. Please open your Bibles to Judges chapter 13. Judges chapter 13. Now, there are two misconceptions worth mentioning as a preface to the preaching. Number one, one might easily visualize Samson of necessity being tall and muscular. Yet that is nowhere stated. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that he was short and fat, nor am I saying that he was scrawny. But we have no physical description or profile given of him, which generally means that he may have looked fairly ordinary, other than the longer hair. See, if he were towering or well-built, the Bible would typically spell it out with King Saul. He was head and shoulder above the rest. Or with Goliath, the Bible carefully documents how he stood at a whopping 6 cubits and a span, equating to approximately 9 feet and 6 inches high. Wow, by the tell of the tape. And when an individual had a foreboding presence, the Bible pulled no punches, because the Bible was always very honest, brutally honest, when it came there to appearances. So Saul was tall, Zacchaeus was short, and Eglon, a king, was a fat man. And for beauty there among the ladies, Rachel had beautiful eyes. Leah, according to some translations, had weak eyes. So if there had been distinguishing physical traits of Samson, I'd suggest it may have been pointed out. Yet because of silence here in this area, I would suggest he looked rather typical. 4 times, it is said that the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, indicating that that was the secret of his great strength and success and superhuman feats. The linen garments or changes of clothing that he finagles and flimflams from the Philistines may have shown that when you looked there at the tag on the collar, you're not going to be reading XXL. Perhaps no one would be swimming around in garments that belonged to Samson over mile-high mountains of muscles or bulging beefcake biceps or pecs piled up to perfection. He may not have been a Tarzan, or a heated-up Hulk, or even a hunk, or a Fabio in the flesh. No indication, in my opinion, that he was a gym junkie. Another popular misconception is that he had to have been very dumb, with an IQ close to zero. And we can reason that way because of choices that he made and how he divulged his deepest details of durability to Delilah, a femme fatale. And we can think of how maybe he was a little light in the belfry, to use the phrase of Foghorn Leghorn. But bear in mind that he was a judge. And as a judge, he had to have the luminosity of leadership. He was intelligent. He loved a riddle. He loved to play a joke. He was a prankster, a naughty rascal at times, clever and crafty. He was quick on his feet, both literally and with his aptitude. So I would say that that would indicate greater mental strength than we would give him credit for. He was not a stupid brute, a meathead, merely on roid rage. He could have been a card-carrying member of the Bright Idea Society. I mean, he knew how to turn a phrase and make a play on words, little rhymes and raps, just right on the spot. Keep in mind that this was a very special child. His father's name was Manoah. His mother's name we do not know. But in Judges chapter 13, verse 5, it was a divine decree that he was to be a Nazarite. Samson was supplied with a special name. Verse 24, Mama called him Samson, meaning sunshine or sun child or bright sun, helping to cultivate charisma and fire up a flair for the dramatic with those that he would encounter or come up against. Some who are sour might brighten a room by just leaving it, and hopefully that's not you, and hopefully that's not me. But Samson could brighten up a room by entering it. After all, here is sunshine. There's sunshine in my soul today. Maybe his mom sung to him the Hebrew equivalent of "You are my sunshine" as she would rock him to sleep. People would be happy to be around him. We're talking about a rather fun guy. The life of a party, swapping jokes and giggling with you and trading out some real knee slappers, I'd say. One captured it like this. Samson was a bundle of contradictions. He was bold before men, yet weak before women. God's spirit was on him, and yet he gave way to the appetites of the flesh. He was called upon to declare war against God's enemies, yet he fraternized with and fellowshiped with them. He fought the Lord's battles by day and broke the Lord's commandments by night. His name Samson meant sunrise, signaling light, but he ended his life in darkness, having his eyes put out. Good people, is it not just incredible that one could soar so high and yet go so low? And yet, can that not at times describe us in the battles that we face routinely? Samson's love for foreign women mirrored Israel's love for foreign gods, or also our love for what we know can be dangerous and forbidden. Sin, after all, is pleasurable. We enjoy it. And yet, Samson's life provides a great, bright caution light to learn and observe and go no further with it. Temptation is going to happen, but let's not yield to temptation. Here is someone who falls from grace in a free fall from the stratosphere, plummeting and plunging from a hero to a zero. He went from a victor to a victim of his own devices. It was a race to the basement. He's quite a paradox. He had amazing potential, but he's the essence of wasted privilege. The Apostle Paul would later say, "To him who thinks he stands, let him do what? Let him take heed lest he fall." 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12. Samson's greatest enemy would prove to be who? Prove to be himself. And your greatest enemy is going to be you. My greatest enemy is going to be me. Now this boy was very blessed. We're talking about a heaping heritage that he had. He was to be a Nazarite. Not to be confused with the later word Nazarene, one from Nazareth. Nazareth seems to have come from Netzer, meaning branch or shoot. Nazarite is from Nazir, meaning consecrated. This word meant different or separated. He was set aside for God. And if you're curious, the requirements for this code that you would live by are found there in Numbers chapter 6. In short, there are three parts to it. Number one, no chugging grape juice, no trace of a taste even of that. Number two, no contact with a corpse. And number three, no trip to the barbershop. Yet Samson had good parents who had very high hopes for him. But the apple at times can roll far away from the tree. And that's precisely what happens in this case. There were two others who were perpetual or continual Nazarites. Do you know them? Samuel? And who else? John the Baptist. Now, in all three cases, there were good parents present, and God chose the parents, and all three couples had trouble having children. Even Samson's mother was said to be barren. But only with Samson did the training get off tracks, leading to tremendous trouble. And in the 14th chapter, we see how life quickly derails for him, leading to a colossal crash and burn, a gut-wrenching wreck that we watch unfold in all its grisly glory. Let's pick up with our reading now in chapter 14, verse 1. Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. So he went up and told his father and mother, saying, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me as a wife. Then his father and mother said to him, Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistine? And Samson said to his father, Get her for me, for she pleases me well. Now, as an up-and-coming judge, he's supposed to be setting the right example. He is supposed to know the Lord and to know the law of the Lord and to be ready to teach that law, the statutes and judgments thereof. And yet he violates a fundamental commandment. Jews were not to be making marriages with idolaters and unbelievers. They were not to be unequally yoked. And it shows us that faith cannot be had in leaders because leaders will let us down often, even in the world of politics, especially perhaps in the world of politics, with whatever affiliation or party one might have or champion. Sooner or later, there's going to be leaders who will bring about shame and disappointment. But here Samson connects himself with the world. He cavorts and compromises with the wrong crowd, much to the public horror of the pious among God's people, I have no doubt. Samson disregarded God's marital plan. And here is the very first step on this downward journey. Remember, he had godly parents who prayed for him, who were filled with great excitement and aspiration over him and his work that he would do that was divinely appointed. And yet one fateful day, he wanders several miles away from home. He kicks back and he caroused with the wrong company. He met a girl who did not know the true God. Oh, she was beautiful. I'm sure she had to be gorgeous. The young judge saw her, and what he saw pleased him well. He fell madly in lust. I'm not entirely convinced that the word love should really be used here. And he decides to marry her. His parents said, Do not do it, Samson. This is a big time no-no. Amos chapter 3, verse 3, Can two walk together unless they are agreed? And we have lots of young people here, so let me see the whites of your eyes, if I might. Who you marry will have a tremendous impact on your spiritual life. A child of God is unwise to marry an unsaved person. In marriage, it's not always just about a boy and a girl. It's often about two families. To marry a non-Christian is to invite in-law problems. One bluntly broached it like this. If you marry a child of the devil, you will have the devil for a father-in-law. John 8:44. Jesus said to certain Jews, You are of your father, the devil. You'll also have mix-ups with your mate, most especially snags with your spouse. How can you be heirs together of the grace of life? How can prayers that are led make their way past the ceiling? Rise above that. You may say that you cannot live without this person here, but if they die in that condition, you'll be separated for all eternity. What disagreements are you going to have? Where to worship on Sunday? Whether to worship on Sunday? A Christian will want to give time and resources to a faithful church of Christ. An irreligious mate will not encourage that. You'll want to bring up your little ones for God and teach them the ways of the Almighty. But a non-Christian might work against that. If not directly, friends, by their influence or through offering alternatives to the offspring. You can go there with mama to church services, or you can come with daddy out to the lake. You'll regard Sunday as the Lord's day. They may well view it as a play day or a lazy day. In spite of all of this, Samson had made up his mind and he was not to be deterred. He was a he-man with a she-weakness. He basically says, she looks hot. But many a woman like this has taken a man to a rather hot place, ultimately. His primary driver in life is what he wants, not what God is wanting for him. Let's press on with verse 5. So Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother and came to the vineyards of Timnah. Now to his surprise, the young lion came roaring against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him. And he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. Now, evidently, that was done back then with relative ease and frequency. It might be hard for us to picture it. What did you do there at the get-together? We played some volleyball, we played cornhole, and we tore apart a kid of the goats. That's how they did this. He had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well. After some time, when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. And behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. He took some of it in his hands and went along eating. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some to them, and they also ate. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. We may ask, what is Samson doing in all of this? First, we could ask, what is he doing in a vineyard? Huh? As a Nazarite, he was not to consume anything that would come from the grapevine. And yet he's surrounded by thousands and thousands of grapes. If one were to spot him right there, could they question his commitment to his vow? Now some might say this is a small matter, but sin often starts out small. Few just go roaring into sin. A poem reads, "Who is it that knocks so loud? A lonely little sin. Slip through," I answer, "and soon all hell was in." He's flirting with disaster. He's playing footsie with it. What true business does he have there? And in the vineyard, he kills a lion. And he's not really to approach anything that has died. It would render a Jew ceremonially unclean. And yet, he had even gone above and beyond that by pledging a personal vow specifically. And maybe it begs the question, just why did Samson not tell his father and mother about the lion that he killed? Now, I'm going to tell you what some would surmise about this, that he was quite modest and wanted to be polite and did not want to be a braggart. I don't quite know about that because he's later going to be writing some little ditties or songs about himself and he'll be running off with gates that belong to a city. See, maybe the next question could be, well, where did you do that, son? Where's the lion? Surely you're not lying about the lion. Two times it is stated that Samson did not tell his parents what he'd done. In verse 6 at the end and also in verse 9 at the end. Perhaps in the second case it was because he knew he had no business being near a corpse. And perhaps in the first case he knew that he had no business being in a vineyard. I mean, we're talking here about how his parents had taught him better. They loved God. They were instructing him in the ways of God. And make no mistake, it shows that he did not take his work, his God-given duty, seriously. And friends, if we fail to stay focused on God's work, it's going to be all too easy for us to dabble with Satan's work. Sin starts small, but it will take you further than you want to go. It will keep you longer than you want to stay. And it will cost you more than you want to pay. That sums it up. Sin makes one stupid. It finds him. It binds him. It blinds him. And it grinds him. Quite literally. no pun intended. He became all too comfortable with the carefree life. Let's look here at verse 10. So his father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a feast there, for young men used to do so. And it happened when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Then Samson said to them, "Let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothing." And they said to him, "Pose your riddle, that we may hear it." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet." How do we go about this? Now for 3 days they could not explain the riddle. But it came to pass on the 7th day that they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take what is ours? Is that not so?" Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, "You only hate me. You do not love me. You have posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me." And he said to her, "Look, I have not explained it to my father or my mother. Should I explain it to you?" Now she had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. And it happened on the 7th day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him, on the 7th day before the sun went down, in other words, just in the nick of time, "What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men and took their apparel and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. So his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. Remarkable. Where to begin, right? Where do we start? It is truly hard to understand Samson's motivations in all of this. If he were an established leader at this point, certainly all of this would have hurt his credibility. The Philistines were oppressing the Israelites. So Samson, what are you going to do? "Well, I'm going to go ahead and befriend them, and I'll even marry one of them." 30 are invited to the wedding feast. Worldly men at a banquet, which takes on the tone of a bachelor party or stag weekend. And one wonders, with all of this, with all of the fun and games and festivities of a week-long celebration, if alcohol might well have been served. It's amazing that some serve alcohol at receptions, given that it's a drink that can lead to the breakup of many marriages. So he says, "Let's make a bet. Let's have some action here. If I stump you, you buy me a wardrobe. But if you solve it, then I pick up the tab." I mean, he's pitching this out to them, not the other way around. Now in verses 5 and 6, a lion met Samson. Maybe the lion thought it would have a Samson steak. Instead, it made a mistake. The beast is slain. Later, bees form a hive in its carcass, potentially there in the abdomen, around the rib cage. Samson says, "Try this humdinger. Try this one here on for size." Well, they were in serious trouble. They're baffled. So what do? They threaten his bride. "There's no honor among thieves, friends. We're going to light you and your family up. There's going to be a bonfire at the end of this party to cap it off, if you don't start talking." Jesus said, "Is not the body more than clothing? But for the wicked, their suits were more valuable to them than human life." Now, there are a number of errors committed by Samson. Error number one, evil companions corrupt good morals. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. He should have stayed away from unhealthy associations, but he did not. It's like he is hardwired to make bad decisions and to be around harmful people. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 20, the companion of fools shall be destroyed. And really and truly, the downfall of Samson, the final demise and even death of Samson can all be traced back to him marrying the wrong woman. Did you catch what I said? I trust that you did. You see, because every incident that you read about from here, every story defining his life comes back to the choice in wife. This is the very first domino that is toppled. There's a ripple effect. It sets off a chain of events, a chain reaction. Samson and the Philistines get caught up in a slugfest. There's a vicious entanglement. It's like they're wrestling in the mud. And in this match, Samson is not going to come out clean. And in fact, this shall claim his very life. Error number two. Samson gets greedy with gambling. How does this not fit the description and definition? There's an uncertain event, arbitrarily chosen. There are the stakes. You have the wager. Someone is going to win. Someone is going to lose. I'm going to take what is yours, or you will take what is mine. Gambling. And as a leader, he sets a foolish example. The proverb writer tells us, he who is greedy for gain troubles his own house. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 27. Samson troubled his own house straight out the gates before his house can even really have much of a foundation. It's crumbling and tumbling down into rubble. Error number three. Samson has no tact in talking to his bride-to-be. Look, I haven't said a peep to mom or dad about this, so why should I tell you? How's that for a sweet talker? What a sensitive man. How's that for treating the woman of your dreams? God's law is for one to leave and cleave. For this cause, a man shall leave father and mother and cleave to his wife, cling to her, and the two, the twain, shall become one flesh. Yet if in-laws weigh in on all the family matters of the new family, that is a recipe for disaster. Some might only know how to cut the wedding cake come the wedding day and not the apron strings. Well, she turns on the waterworks. She starts to cry. Just like if you were to take a match and hold it up there to a ceiling fire alarm, you're going to get the sprinklers spouting off. And here is a man who could stand against a lion and later against armies of Philistine warriors, but a woman's tears he could not resist. So he waves the white flag of surrender. He capitulates. There's just no trust in this relationship, for she does not look to Samson as her protector, period. And once she knows, then guess what? They all know of her countrymen. Here's another error, error number four. We see how he distorted his purpose. Now, the Philistines are rubbing their hands with glee, and they return to Samson and say, "What is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion?" And then he calls his wife a cow. Now, I have not done a lot of marriage counseling, but I'm going to go out on a limb to recommend that you do not do that, men. What's his point? No one really plows with a heifer, a young female cow that has not born a calf, and generally under 3 years of age. The claim is you broke the rules. You see, you don't plow there with heifers. You plow with oxen. So he's saying you broke the rules. You weren't playing by the rules. And the judge is so infuriated that he kills 30 Philistines, those who probably had not a clue about all that was going on, takes their clothing and pays off his debt. Now, friends, something is happening here. It's occurring right now. Whose battles is he really fighting? His or God's? Some may start to fight personal battles. They do so for personal reward or even for spite. Paul revealed to the church there at Philippi in Philippians chapter 1, verse 15, some preach Christ from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains. But the latter out of love, knowing that I'm appointed for the defense of the gospel. What is our motive here? Why are we here? What is our purpose? What are we doing? Let it ever be to preach Jesus Christ and Him crucified, and to exalt His body, the church. Let's stop shaming the church and start proclaiming the church. For we preach not ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves as bondservants for the sake of others. We are to fight the Lord's battles, not our own. And this is no way to kick off a marriage. If you are arguing and fighting on your wedding day, the honeymoon is over even before it started, even before the ink is dry on your certificate. One made the observation that some can spend a lot of time planning a wedding ceremony, but the marriage falls to pieces because they did not spend any time planning the marriage. How true. Oh, Samson thought he knew her. But what did he really know? He saw her. He liked her that way. Beauty was just skin deep. If you mill this around, Samson would have been better off just staying single. At least in being single, he could have had his focus on God more so. At least there'd be greater chances of that. Sidestepping this murderous mayhem. But if you find the wrong one, that can take you from God. There was a preaching friend who counseled me, knowing that I'm a bachelor, knowing that I'm in the hunt, so to speak. He said, you got to make sure you get that right one, because if you don't, you're not going to get your sermons done. And I'm sure there'll be a whole lot more to the story in the problem sector, but certainly that's part of it. A young man needs a helpmeet, not a hellcat, not a hindrance meet. And if you're falling for one whom you're hoping that you can change and that you believe that you can change, the reality is that you may never do so. Rarely do you pull them up. More often they will pull you down. And you're going to look back on years that you invested that could have been spent elsewhere potentially. And now you're in a marriage that might be like a prison house or like solitary confinement. Samson, Samson, Samson. He was thinking with his hormones and not with his head. And the bride-to-be was given over to who? Did you catch that? To Samson's companion who had been his best man. What kind of a friend does that? Who makes off with your girl? What in the world? Maybe there was an ancient version of Rick Springfield's Jesse's Girl. I wish I had Samson's girl. Where can I find a woman like that? Oh, here she is. Samson is a friend. Yeah, I know he's been a good friend of mine, but lately something's changed. That ain't hard to define. Samson's got himself a girl, and I want to make her mine. He could have had a hit just in hitting on this woman. You see, if Samson had chosen after all of this debacle here to just cut his losses, scrap it all, go back to his parents and focus on the Lord and Jehovah's purposes, he could have freed himself and liberated himself from worldly strife and had a fresh start and exited that bus before it made it stop there at the cemetery. But as we shall see, he keeps his seat. But God had an overriding purpose with Samson, and that was to beat back the Philistines, since the Jews were now at this stage crying out to Yahweh in sorrow over their sin. And when Samson cries out too, guess what? God hears him as well. Though the physical consequences would be irrevocable. But let us learn that God is a God of great compassion and mercy. A broken and contrite heart the Lord will not despise or refuse. Psalm 34, verse 18, the Lord is near to those who have a broken heart, save such with a contrite spirit. Our appeal is to call upon God while he might yet be found. That's what we plead with people to do. Let us not be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin, but keep that heart tender. Have a heart of flesh, not of stone. Let us bring Christ our broken life, so marred by sin. He will create anew, make whole again. Your empty, wasted years he will restore, and your iniquities remember no more. How about that? Let's respond to the Lord's invitation, loving and generous as it is. Become a Christian today. Jesus shed that precious blood, paying that ransom price. How high, how steep it was, so that we could have the joys and the riches of eternal glory in heaven with him. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. Be faithful until death to have that crown of life. If we can help you toward this end, make your way down to the front. Let your request be made known while we stand and sing the song that's been announced.